Welcome to another edition of 360 with Ohio State Athletics, presented by Kroger. I'm Tyler Danberg, and each episode we talk to a different Ohio State head coach to learn more about their career and program. Fencing head coach Donald Anthony Jr. has spent a life in the sport. A star fencer at Princeton and later Team USA, Anthony has helped continue the growth of the sport as an entrepreneur, business leader, chairman and president for USA Fencing, and as head coach for Buckeye Fencing. We had the chance to go out to Ohio State Fencing's Steelwood Training Facility to learn more about Anthony, his program, and where his fencing journey began.
Oh, as I think Bill Cosby said on the album, I started off as a child, and it was in Cleveland, Ohio. I was about 7 or 8 years old. I was watching Zorro as a kid and said, Mom, I want to learn how to do that. And my mother, being the resourceful librarian that she was, found a inner city cultural center in Cleveland, Ohio called Caramu House, where I started fencing.
What about Zorro made you so excited to fence?
Well, he was the swashbuckling hero, you know, with the sword. And I just thought it was just so cool, especially when he made the mark of the Z.
When you did get involved, how quickly did you start to fall in love with the sport?
I fell in love with the sport immediately. I will say that when I first started, I was not the best at it. My cousin, who's 6 days older than I am, we started at the same time. He was a super talented athlete, and he was really good. And it wasn't until probably we were 11 where I was able to get to that level of competition.
When did you think that you could compete at the level that you would end up competing in?
You know, I really didn't even think about that. Once I got to college, I started noticing that my teammates and roommates were Olympians. So I said, well, maybe me too.
You moved to Cincinnati, and you said for about 6 or 7 years didn't fence and picked it back up when you got to college. What made you want to pick the sport back up again?
I actually never stopped wanting to fence, but there were no opportunities for youth in Cincinnati. Fortunately, in Cleveland, they had kids programs, but in Cincinnati, there was nothing for anybody who wasn't in college at that point. So I played football, basketball, ran track, played tennis, and was on a gymnastics team. All of those were great preparation for when I finally came back to the sport as an athlete.
How did playing multiple sports help you as a fencer?
Just being a really well-trained athlete. I would say of all the sports, that was the year that I grew like 6 inches and I lost complete control over my body and didn't make the basketball team. So I was on the gymnastics teams for 1 year. That was probably one of the best experiences, along with studying martial arts too.
Before you got to college, who were your mentors in the sport?
You know, I wouldn't say mentors, but my idols were my dear friend Peter Westbrook, Tyrone Simmons, Ruth White. These were all people who were in the 70s, early 70s Olympians. And I was like, oh, I want to be one of them.
So what was your college recruiting journey like? What do you remember about being pursued or maybe even pursuing Princeton, your alma mater?
You know, I didn't get pursued because I hadn't fenced. I was a walk-on. You know, when I got to Princeton, I mean, I got in. I was an engineer. I went to the coach, and I said, I want to learn to fence. He was like, that's fine. But then I realized I had a high school All-American and a New York City champion, both in the same weapon I had fenced when I was younger, which was foil. And I said, well, you know, I would like to fence sometime while I'm here. So that's when I switched to saber.
What do you remember about those first times going against them in Sabre?
Oh, well, in Sabre, I was much better. I had taken a few Sabre lessons when I was a kid, so I understood the weapon. They did not fence Sabre, so I didn't really have any problems with them at that point.
What do you remember about that time when you were walking on?
You know, it was brand new. It was a much smaller team and a much smaller sport at that point in time. What I do remember is that I was well received, and I was an extremely good athlete. So my athletic talents were definitely superior to my fencing talents at that point in time.
When you look back, Don, at your college fencing career, what are some of your favorite memories that stand with you?
You know, I say the one that is probably the biggest was our Eastern Collegiate Championships my senior year. We won the Easterns. I was the Eastern champion. And then, you know, I went to the NCAAs. But that was after I had really sprained my ankle in the Easterns. They told me I probably shouldn't even compete and finish that competition. I did, but I paid for it. And the ankle was really... I thought that after the NCAAs, I wouldn't fence again. But that changed once I got to New York and started working in the city.
And so you spent 10 years in New York City working at IBM, sales and marketing. What do you remember from that time the most?
You know, I would say the biggest thing was I was in a marketing group. It was a high-stress group, but it was going to practice after working and just everything being out of your mind. You know, and then part of that was I met Peter Westbrook. I met him when I was in college, and he was like, hey, we were both out for lunch. I worked at 42nd and 3rd. He was on 5th Avenue, and he was like, look, come on back, you know, and that was the way I came back to fencing. And, you know, that whole time, that was my alternative to working hard.
Peter Westbrook, you've mentioned him a few times, and we'll get into him a little bit later on, but you said that he was one of the first idols of yours in the sport, and now you're getting to interact with him and building a relationship with him. Was there ever a moment where you sat back and reflected, oh my gosh, I'm getting to be around one of my idols?
You know, I would say that was in the first, like, maybe week of being there. But, you know, I mean, it's one thing to be with an idol. It's another thing to train and compete and fence with an idol. And after that point, the idol goes away. So, but I do reflect on the fact that I was so fortunate that we became very dear friends. My first time actually seeing him in person was at the 76 Olympic trials. They were held at Princeton. I was invited to be a judge. Side judge, and that's when I really got to see him. But then I didn't get to know him until afterward. I trained with him before the NCAAs. But then when you are on a team together, you travel together, that's when the bonds really formed.
How did he make you better?
He just beat on me every time he had an opportunity and told me, hey, you got to do this, do that. And, you know, just steel sharpening steel. Yeah.
Knowing what you do now, being a head coach for as long as you have been, what is Don Anthony's scouting report of Don Anthony, the fencer?
You know, I would say talent. When I was a young fencer, my technique was not as high as it is now. I did that post-college. You know, as a fencer, I've been on a couple of world teams. I've finished well. I just wish I had more time to develop because I started late at that level. But, you know, not bad. I take him.
What was it like to get to compete on those world championship teams, specifically the ones in 89 and 95?
You know, I would say 89 was probably the one that was most significant for me just because I'd been an alternate for 84. I'd been an alternate for both of those Olympic teams. Finally breaking through, being in the top three, that was just a major accomplishment. And then, you know, fencing, the world championships in 89 were in Denver. So fencing at home, representing your country, that, and being, you know, on the team with Peter and Bob and Mike and Steve Mormondo, these were all my guys, all from the club. It was just one of the most memorable experiences of my life.
For those that may not be familiar, how do you go about even cracking those rosters?
Well, you have to be consistent. So we have what's called a point system, and it's accumulation of how you do in about five competitions across the year. And, you know, you just have to be consistent, and you have to be good, and you have to be able to just stay in the hunt. And at the end of the day, you see how you did.
While you were at IBM, you also got your MBA from the prestigious Wharton School of Business of Penn. How did that lay the groundwork for a lot of your future entrepreneurial ventures?
You know, part of the reason why I decided to go to business school, one, I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur, but I also knew I wanted to be a promoter. And, you know, that was in like 85, 86. We were in some dingy gym in New Jersey for our national championships. And I'm like, you know, this does not make sense. So the Wharton School gave me some of those skills as an entrepreneur. I majored in entrepreneurial management and finance. And that sort of gave me the business framework for doing the things that I wanted to do.
What were some of those skills that you learned then that stick with you the most now?
I would say, how do you raise money? How do you run a business? And most importantly, how do you promote and market anything? And those skills are universal, but they're applying them. Now I'm applying them to Ohio State fencing.
So what led you to start SwordSport LLC?
You know, that was after many years of, you know, working in the promotion, had an idea of what this sport could be if you really put together showcase, marketing, just premier events to demonstrate the sport so that not only fencers understood it, but for wider audiences with all of the things that go to creating a popular sport. And, you know, that was the motivation for SwordSport.
How do you go about marketing fencing to a more mass audience compared to the niche fencing fan audience?
You know, right now I tell people it's very simple. You just really have to tell the story, and you have to do it in a way that it's for non-fencers. People care about who the athletes are. They care about what it takes to be successful. If you get that across, that's the bottom line. And then you explain to them why this is important. For me, it's been very simple. These come from weapons. People are trying to kill each other. The rules are based upon who would have died and who would have lived.
What's been your most rewarding part about SwordSport and getting to be a part of a venture that is marketing fencing to a wider audience?
You know, I would say right now, I mean, we've had some really good accomplishments. We did the first live stream of any world championships for the FIE over dial-up in 2000. I would say, you know, a major accomplishment was the documentary that we did on African-American fencers. That was part of the Arnold Schwarzenegger Festival. We premiered there. And then right now is really that time where the FIE, USA Fencing, other people are finally realizing that professional fencing is a viable property. And that's really where we are now. And I'm looking forward to collaborating with all of those folks and taking it, getting ready for LA 2028.
When did you realize that it'd be possible to be the chairman and president of USA Fencing like you did?
I did not ever think that that was possible. I didn't even think about it. I had been secretary of the board from 2000 to 2004. I hated it. I said I would never do anything like that again. Well, 8 years later, after having a great president when I was secretary, they'd had a couple of presidents that just really didn't function well. The organization was $1.5 million in the red. It was just completely in shambles. I got drafted. So it was like my friends were like, why are you going to do that? But you can't promote a sport if it's not a healthy sport, if it's not doing well with with the Olympic Committee, U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, then you're not going to be successful. So that's why I allowed myself to be drafted. And then, you know, the rewards were turning that around. You know, by the time I left in 2000, after two terms, we were one of the strongest fencing countries in the world.
How did that come to be?
A lot of it was changing the culture. I had a great treasurer who worked out the finances. We really figured out how we could generate more income and really changing the board and getting a board that realized that, you know, fencers, they'd come on the board. We have to tell them, leave your weapons outside the door because, you know, bury the hatchet so we can get work done. By the time we accomplished that, we had a very high functioning organization and we worked well. And I had a very good CEO.
What moments stick with you the most from your time serving in your role with USA Fencing?
I would say the getting through that first 4 years of building the credibility, building the economic base, and being able to support our athletes to achieve what they wanted to do. 2016 results in Brazil were amazing. And then, you know, I would say being able to see the organization in a very solid footing and people working together. That stands out for me. And then just seeing the revenue constantly growing.
Do you feel like, Don, those first 4 years of turning something around and building USA Fencing back to where it had been previously, do you compare some of that to like building a college program?
You know, I'm very much similar to a college program. And in some ways, when I came to this program, I didn't know that I would be using a lot of those same skill sets. I inherited a lot of issues when I came in as head. So, you know, I found out as a head coach, I didn't just have to do that job, but because of the challenges we were having as a program, I ended up using all of my skills, from my consulting skills of building high-performance organizations and managing, you know, just I won't say chaos, but the crisis type of management, and then building, you know, the base, and then changing the culture of the program. Those were the things that I focused on, and those are the same skills that I used in other places.
And now, a word from our friends at Kroger.
Enjoy more ways to save at Kroger, like low prices in every aisle. And when you download the Kroger app, you can clip and save more with digital coupons every week. Plus, you can earn fuel points to save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. At Kroger, you can enjoy more ways to save and more rewards every time you shop. So it's always easy to save big every day with savings and rewards. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Fuel restrictions apply. See site for details.
Now back to our conversation with Donald Anthony Jr.
So what led you to Ohio State, Don?
You know, when I moved to Columbus in 97, my, quote, godfather in the sport of fencing was Vice President of International Federation. He was Hungarian, and the coach here, Charlotte Remenick, was also Hungarian. They were very good friends. First order of business, he said, you have to go down and help Charlotte with her Sabre program. So I went down, and I started working with the program. By 2000, she retired, or 1999, she retired. They asked me to be part of the committee that helped bring in the next coach. And they brought Vladimir Nazlimov in 2000. Archie Griffin was the athletic assistant sport AD at that time. So I started working with fencing and Ohio State in 2000. When he retired, they asked me to help them find their next coach. I had built a long relationship with the athletic department with Gene. And at that point, they were like, you know, the sport AD said, we don't know anybody who knows more about fencing than you do. I was also vice president of the National Federation at the time. And I was like, I love this program. I will do whatever it takes to keep it and make it successful. If I'm the guy, then I'll be happy to do it.
What was it like getting to work with Archie Griffin?
Oh, Archie's just an amazing human being. He's just such a gentleman. He's such a warm-hearted person, and he's just very, very committed to excellence. So it was a great experience.
How similar, how different were your first couple years as a head coach of a college fencing program compared to any of your previous roles in fencing and beyond?
Well, my first 2 years as a head coach here were very challenging. We found ourselves under sanctions. We lost a lot of the coaches. I had to rebuild my staff. I would say it was probably one of the most challenging periods. Getting through it was also one of the most rewarding. To see the athletes go from, I had a consultant come in, and he said, you know, you can visit Pity Valley, but you can't live there. And watching them come out of Pity Valley and then getting to the point where we have a high-performing team, that was just an amazing experience.
What did your athletes do to get out of Pity Valley?
They accepted the fact that the reality was that if you stay there, you will be miserable for the rest of your life, and there are other alternatives. And that's what we did. We've really focused on the alternatives of how do we build the culture? How do we come back? How do we get the coaches that we need? How do we get the leadership that we need? And building that leadership culture was the biggest part of that.
What were some of those alternatives from what you remember?
First and foremost is focus on your fencing and not on the environment around you. Realize that, you know, you didn't create this. This is the cards that you were dealt, and now you have the opportunity to play them. And when we got them to realize that and that they could still accomplish their goals as far as their competitive goals, we could accomplish our team goals, we could still be successful after that first year, then it became, you know, changing that whole culture and mindset.
When did you really feel like the program had hit its climb?
And competitively, we were probably about the second year, we were the best team in the country. Unfortunately, it was a COVID year. And that really hurt because we had 7 All-Americans returning out of 12, and there was no question about that. So that was the first step. But then now it's been uphill since then. We lost the season because of the violations. Then we had COVID, so we were out for like 2 years. Coming back was when we really started getting to the program. And I would say, even though we competitively have done well, we've had All-Americans, we've had national champions. We had a national championship champion this year. This was one of our best seasons. And the culture of the team was the culture I've been working for, and we finally got it.
So looking back at 2026, we'll start on the women's side, and we'll start off with Natalia Botello, the reigning national champion in Sabre, the first women's Sabre national champion in program history. What was it like getting to see the run that she had this year?
That was amazing. Even now, I'm like tearing up from just the excitement and the work. Last year, she finished third. She went in this year, I'm going to win. And just seeing her just persevere in the gym. She's in the gym, was in the gym this morning taking lessons, getting ready for the next World Cup. It was just so nice to see her and her coach, because it happens together. And the fact that she beat Magda Skarmanekevich, who's also a multiple-time world champion, and the way she did it, that control, there's nothing better than that.
How did she do it? How'd she claim the national title?
She just mentally went in and said, it belongs to me. And she beat everybody with position and just stayed mentally tough. Even in her previous bout against a fencer who she struggles with, it got close. She just stayed focused and did what she was supposed to do, fenced her game. And she did the same thing against Magda in the final bout.
On the men's side, a highlight was a win over the eventual national champions in Notre Dame. The foil team claimed its 6th straight conference title. Specifically on the foil side, what's made that team so dominant for a half decade plus?
Well, you know, I will say it really is because of the coach, Elvis Gregory. I mean, Elvis is, I say, the legendary Elvis Gregory. He's got 3 Olympic medals. He's got an individual silver, 2 bronze in the team, world champion. I mean, he brings that, and he did that for Cuba. And coming out of that system, they work hard, they focus. There's an expectation that you deliver results, and he loves his athletes, and they love him. And they're in the gym working with him no matter what, all the time, on their own, voluntarily, because they want to be successful, and they know that he is with them to make them successful.
You've mentioned your coaches, Don. All 4 of your coaches on your staff are Olympians. For your athletes, how special is it to get to work with Olympians day in, day out?
You know, I think it's two-sided. One, they bring a skill set, which it goes without saying. But it's also knowing that they have accomplished this, and they will work with you to help you accomplish it. And those, I have athletes who are trying to make Olympic teams. We've had athletes who have made Olympic teams. And by having coaches that have been there and done that at the highest level, it's a transferable mindset. Not necessarily a skill, but it's definitely a mindset.
What makes an Olympian in fencing?
You know, first of all, you have to hard work, and then also being at the right place at the right time. There are a lot, like I've never made an Olympic team because I never was able to do that in one of those years. So timing is important, and then the perseverance of just doing it over and over again, win or lose, keeping your mindset that you are still going to win no matter what it looks like ahead of you.
So for people, Don, that might be tuning in, learning about fencing for the first time, first off, you are a wealth of knowledge in that regard. Why should fans get into the sport?
First of all, I mean, the sport is a combination of both art and combat. And, you know, fencing is, sword fighting is extremely popular in the movies. It's exciting to watch. I think the one thing that we have to do a little bit better job of is the presentation, a lot better job of the presentation and the rules. But people get into fencing and fans come because it's fast, it's fun, it's exciting. And we have great athletes and amazing stories.
What should people know about fencing that they might not know yet?
I would say what they probably should know is that it's not that complicated, and it's a lot of fun to watch. And I think that what they may not know is how international the sport is. A lot of times people think of fencing as this old, stodgy European sport. Well, right now at the Olympics, Asia had three of the top medals, and the U.S. had the other one of the top four. Same thing at the World Championships that we just had in Brazil in the junior cadets. So it's a big international sport. It's well represented. A lot of exciting people and a lot of interesting people.
14 athletes on your roster are from international waters or from Canada or a country overseas. How do you recruit internationally?
So we go to a lot of the international events. We go to the World Championships, junior and senior. And then we use our athletes to help identify talent. We go out, we look at them, we follow the FIE rankings. And then when we get there, we try to make those personal relationships. Now, we're not the only ones competing. We compete against Notre Dame, and they have been very successful. They also have a much bigger purse than we do, which doesn't. That helps a lot. But we compete and we really show our brand. The one thing that Ohio State has is we have the best athletic department in the world. And we've tried to market that, and we show them that you can come here, you can train, you can still be successful with your national program, and we will give you everything you need to be successful.
Born in Cleveland, lived in Cincinnati, live in Columbus right now. How much in-state pride do you carry leading the program, and how do you think that helped you in recruiting?
You know, first of all, it's a huge honor. I mean, to be a head coach at The Ohio State University is something that I never expected, and I feel very fortunate. As far as in-state in Ohio, Ohio's a great state. Ohio State is a great university. I'm just very proud to be part of it.
So in fencing, there's three disciplines: saber, foil, épée. What are the similarities? What are the differences between those three weapons?
So I'll start with the foil. The foil is the lightest weapon. And because it was light, you had to hit somewhere on your torso because you had to hit a heart, a lung, a spleen. I mean, these are weapons. So that's the target area. And that's the biggest difference. And foil is also what's called logical rules. If somebody's about to hit you, you're going to do two things. You're either going to block it or get out of the way. If you just hit at the same time, that person would have been dead. So that's the rules for that one. The other, and it's a point weapon. You can only hit, you can only stab. Épée is also a point weapon, but it comes from the dueling sword. So you dishonored my family, you looked at me wrong, you're going out whether I die or not. So that weapon you can score at the same time. The target area is the whole body. It's a heavier weapon. It's got a triangular blade because you could duel to first blood or not. And you have to be able to see, oh, he's hit, end of duel. So that's a dueling sword. And then saber, which is the weapon I fence, was fought on horseback. So the target area is everything above the waist. And it's the only weapon that you can cut and stab with. And once again, you did not want to cut the horse because that was the spoils of war. So you didn't hit anything below the waist. And you also had the logical rule of if I'm going to get hit, I'm going to block it or get out of the way.
How often do you build the roster based off of weapons?
Always. We right now, because of the new rules, we're allowed for 24 women, so we try to have 8 women in each weapon. Men, we're only down to 20, which leaves us, usually we would want 7, but we can only have 6. So we look at what the talent is, how much talent we have, and we try to keep at least 6 per weapon and 7 in one.
How often do you see an athlete change weapons in their college careers?
Only if they are very, very brand new and or have never fenced before or not been at a very high level. But that is not a normal thing.
Big picture question here, Don. How have you seen the sport grow in your 30 plus years in the sport?
Well, let's put it this way. When I started with USA Fencing, there were like 5,000 members. Now they're pushing 50,000 members. I've seen it change from the standpoint of there were just the European countries that were dominant to it's a truly a global international sport. There are now 156, 157 national federations. So I've watched it grow from that standpoint. When I was growing up, I remember 1989, we had a world championships in a World Cup in New York, brought a full broadcast truck over, did a compete piece. We were trying to get it on ESPN, and they wanted us to pay money. Now they pay money to have us on their networks because there is an audience in China. In Hong Kong, it is the most popular sport in Hong Kong right now because of all the success that they've had. So those are the kinds of things that have really changed from the standpoint of the coverage, the visibility, the number of athletes, and also the money. I mean, in this last World Championships, you know, they're giving away $1 million+ for the winners.
When you think of the growth of the sport, who do you think of?
When I think of the growth of the sport, I think of really U.S. Growth. And then, like I said, Asia, China. China is really crazy. I mean, it has grown so much in that country. There are thousands and thousands of clubs, and there's so many fencers there. But that's where the real growth is, in Asia and the U.S.
Outside of Ohio State, where else are you involved in the sport?
Well, I'm still Vice President of the International Federation. I'm still on the International Relations Group with USA Fencing. Still involved in, you know, the company Sword Sport, really trying to figure out how to bring more money in. And especially in light of the changes in college athletics with NIL, we want to be able to have professional opportunities for all the athletes around the country, especially Ohio State. But those are the kinds of things that I'm still involved in. The Peter Westbrook Foundation, I'm still on their advisory council. So I wear a lot of hats.
And a co-board of advisor on that board is none other than Neil Diamond, who is a member of the 1960 NCAA National Champion Fencing Team at NYU. What has it been like in your fencing career to get to be around Neil Diamond?
You know, Neil Diamond, of course, he's legendary, but I had a young lady that I work with, and all she wanted to do was to be able to be in the company of Neil Diamond. So it's been really good. And that's the other thing that we're starting to do. As we're going for LA 2028, we have a lot of our athletes trying to make that. I'm involved in that as well, the LA 2028 build up for fencing, and we really want to start bringing those brand ambassadors in, the Neil Diamonds, the Bruce Dickinson and then Jackson Wang, the K-pop star. These are the kinds of people that are involved in our sport, but we really haven't used them to explain the sport and build popularity for the sport.
So what all is going into the preparations for the LA Olympics in 2028?
Well, so far I've been there twice this year. We're looking at the venue. Last games at the Grand Palais, one of the most beautiful structures in the world. We're in the Los Angeles Coliseum this year. So someone said, we have to figure out how to make this venue look good. I think he used something like perfuming the pig. So, you know, it's not the great venue, but we're going to do everything to really lean in to Hollywood and the production.
What is your favorite part about being a head coach at Ohio State?
Working with the absolutely amazing young people that I get to work with and being part of the OSU athletic department. And really the head coaches and the coaching staff and all the other people in that department.
Yeah, how often do you get to interact with all the people from other sports in the athletic department?
We have a what's called Built to Lead program where for the head coaches. That's one of my favorite things is when we get the chance to meet as head coaches. Usually there'll be from, you know, 7 to 15 of us, because our schedules are so crazy. I can't make every one of them. But that's one of the best times to actually interact with them.
Have you gotten any of the other coaches to suit up?
Haven't got any of the other coaches to suit up. We've done exchanges with the pistol and rifle, the pistol program. We also had softball, women's softball in here. So we haven't had the coaches, but we've had the athletes.
That's Ohio State fencing head coach Donald Anthony Jr. Thank you so much for the time and best of luck the rest of the way.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. Tyler, keep up the great work.
Thank you so much. To keep tabs on the Ohio State men's and women's fencing programs, visit OhioStateBuckeyes.com and be sure to check for future episodes of the show as we get to know more head coaches at Ohio State. Once again, I'm Tyler Danberg, and this has been 360 with Ohio State Athletics, presented by Kroger.